Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the U.S. Supreme Court decides North Carolina's congressional district map is not a partisan gerrymander. Despite protest and controversy, Charlotte City Council adopts a new noise ordinance. We get closer to adding a quarter cent to Mecklenburg County sales tax, but the county commission is split on that, and the state senate votes yes on a House bill that would force sheriffs to cooperate with ICE. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories. Those reporters include Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV Eyewitness News. Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com and a contributor to WCCB-TV, is here. And Jonathan Lowe is reporter anchor for Spectrum News. We're all on the radio. You can watch us on Facebook Live if the radio isn't enough. And in light of yesterday's Supreme Court decision on North Carolina's gerrymandering case, Dr. Michael Bitzer will start us off. He's an expert in the area and is a professor of history and politics at Catawba College. Welcome back to you.
Good to be here.
Yesterday, as we all know, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that North Carolina's congressional map is not an unconstitutional gerrymander. It gave Republicans in the General Assembly a victory in the case. Russo versus Common Cause. The Russo in that case is former Mecklenburg County State Senator Bob Russo. He called the ruling a validation.
The U.S. Supreme Court basically said the way we established those districts in drawing the maps is totally constitutional, and the court has no role to play both on the federal and on the state level dealing with politics.
So the court, Michael, said the state's map is not, I hope I pronounced this correctly, judiciable.
Justiciable.
Okay.
There's justice.
Okay, so what does that mean?
It means that there are certain factors that courts have to take into account before they can rule on an issue. One of them is standing. Do you have a legal injury that the courts can resolve? Another is mootness, rightness. The final one, and this was what hinged the entire majority opinion, is the political question doctrine. And the courts are very hesitant to insert themselves into issues that are highly politically charged. And what Chief Justice Roberts said was, this is a political question best left to the legislatures, to the executive branches, to the states.
How can he say that in the face of the fact that these problems are being caused by legislatures?
Well, he acknowledged that there are ways around the legislature that citizens can get engaged. They can participate in the vote. They can do ballot initiatives.
They're being shut out of the vote. Seriously.
Well, that is part of the blowback against the opinion, is that I'm just stating what Chief Justice Roberts says. The issue is, if the districts are so heavily gerrymandered, can the voters really have an impact on the final say of who composes a legislature?
So Chief Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion, and he said, quote, numerous states are actively addressing the issue through state constitutional amendments and legislation placing power to draw electoral districts in the hands of independent commissions, mandating particular redistricting criteria for their map makers, or prohibiting drawing district lines for partisan advantage. How many states are actually doing that?
A number of states, particularly last year, adopted such amendments. Missouri was one. I believe Michigan was another. And they're also, it's not just the voters getting engaged, it's also state courts. And I think this is where North Carolina may play out in terms of partisan gerrymandering. There's a case going through the courts right now challenging the state legislative districts on the grounds of too much partisan gerrymandering. So that will go up to the state Supreme Court. There's a provision in the North Carolina Constitution, the Free Elections Clause, Article 1, Section 10, that says all elections shall be free in North Carolina. This is similar to what Pennsylvania did, and they struck down partisan gerrymandering.
So he was joined, Chief Justice Roberts was joined in that opinion by all of the conservatives.
Yes.
On the court, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch. Why, if the court has ruled that racial gerrymandering is not constitutional, do they claim that political gerrymandering is or can't be ruled on when there's so much overlap between what is racial gerrymandering and what is political gerrymandering.
And particularly in the South, race and politics are one and the same. When you're dealing with issues like racial polarized voting, black voters tend to be highly Democratic, 95% of the time voting Democratic. White Southern voters tend to be much more Republican. So there is racial polarized voting going on. What Chief Justice Roberts argued was there were standards by which courts could intervene and say this is too much racial gerrymandering or this is sufficient. That's questionable as well because they've never given a very concrete number in terms of if you have a district with black percentage voting, that's okay or it's not. It's kind of one of those I know it when I see it kind of things.
Before we started this program, I asked you if you were surprised, and you said no, because Justice Roberts kind of telegraphed this well in advance of this decision. He wrote that Congress could pass laws to prevent politically oriented districts, but asking the courts to do so would be, quote, an unprecedented expansion of judicial power. Why? They make decisions all the time that overrule the Congress, that overrule the president, that overrule state legislatures. Why would this be an expansion of judicial power?
I think in this polarized environment, the courts recognize that if they inserted themselves into partisan gerrymandering, it would
Didn't they insert themselves into the civil rights movement? Into the voting? Seriously.
Yes, Mike, they did. And also Congress inserted itself by the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act
of
1965.
If you have three branches of government and the first two are political and the third is not, isn't it the job of the third branch of government to get involved in the disputes that are political and settle them? Because you're never going to settle them otherwise.
Correct, and the courts make the discretionary decision of when they will insert themselves and when they won't.
And the thing of it is now you said you have the two branches, but there will those who say that now the third branch, the judicial branch, is getting increasingly politicized as well, particularly even the Supreme Court, which, as we know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell did not allow President Obama's nominee to get on the court. And you could see that Justice Elena Kagan read this blistering dissent saying that this really strikes at the heart of democracy.
Could not this then be seen as a political decision by the court when you have all five conservative justices saying we can't get involved and the four liberal judges saying this is a travesty of justice?
It's politics.
Yeah.
I mean, it is purely and simply politics. And when I teach the courts, I say the courts are just as political, but in different ways from the legislative and executive
branches. So when you heard Republicans in North Carolina react to this yesterday as a validation or vindication of their point of view on this, and it's not just Republicans who do this. In the Maryland case, which they also took a look at yesterday, it was Democrats who did this. So they could be hurting themselves with this decision unbeknownst to them at the moment. The political winds could change, and they could be shut out in the past as they have been in the future, as they have been in the past. But given their opinion on what the court's opinion was, that this is a validation, their conduct is likely not to change.
So
is Congress, Judge Roberts pointed to Congress and legislatures as the bodies that will make these changes. Are they likely to make any changes at all?
In the House, House Bill 1 addresses a lot of these issues and will force the states to have an independent redistricting commission. That will go nowhere because it will die in the Senate and likely be, if it did get passed by the Senate, be vetoed by the president. The states have the luxury to do so, and I think state courts will probably be the ones that step up.
So here is how NBC News worded their interpretation of that decision yesterday. They said the court rejected claims that partisan politics played too great a role in the way congressional districts were designed in North Carolina to the benefit of Republicans and in Maryland to the advantage of Democrats. You're shaking your head no on that. But
Chief Justice Roberts said these are partisan issues and this partisanship is intense. He wrote that in the opinion. So, he acknowledged
so you're saying
that it is partisan.
NBC's interpretation is wrong.
I would say that I would have written a different synopsis, shall we say.
Okay.
Well, Chief Justice Roberts, actually, he admitted this doesn't smell right, let's
no,
face
no, exactly.
it. And so, yeah, well, and he's walking this tightrope because he realizes that the reputation of the court as an independent body is actually at stake. And he knows that the American, I mean, they pay attention to what's going on, that the American public is seeing, okay, it's increasingly politicized. And you could see, we haven't talked about the census question, when he joined the other four justices, that he's trying to walk this tightrope. Mm-hmm.
He also said that one of the challenges is determining when partisan gerrymandering goes too far. So, yeah, he acknowledged that partisan gerrymandering.
Okay,
happened.
Well, let's talk about that, because in the North Carolina case, State Representative David Lewis of Harnett County said the GOP drew a map with 10 GOP-leaning seats and three Democratic seats because, quote, I do not believe it's possible to draw a map with Republicans, with 11 Republicans and two Democrats. And he also said, I think electing Republicans is better than electing Democrats, because drawing the map this way helps us to foster what I think is better for the country. Is that not a blatant display of partisan politics playing too large a role in designing districts, something that the Supreme Court ought to jump into?
To the victors go the spoils.
Yes. Yeah.
And
your
the spoils
vote matters.
And the spoils then end in a year that ends with zero is the most important.
But it's interesting. You said it's going to go to the court, and it's in the state of North Carolina. It's democratically controlled.
Exactly. Six to one.
So we don't know what's going to happen there.
So this ruling doesn't just uphold North Carolina and Maryland's mm-hmm. map. It opens the door to other states to do what North Carolina has done, does it not?
Yes.
So what might be the impact to our democracy going forward of this decision?
It will continue the hyperpolarization of our politics until and unless the citizens decide this is too much.
How
this
do
is
citizens
a citizen
do that?
Driven. Well, that there's a variety of measures, but this is going to be incumbent. Say, for example, here in North Carolina, if the state Supreme Court doesn't strike down partisan gerrymandering, it is incumbent upon Democrats to at least try and claim one chamber of the legislature next year, because that's when the new cycle of redistricting will begin.
So in the Maryland case, it was about Democrats drawing a district, their state's 6th congressional district, to favor a Democrat over a Republican. And the former governor, Martin O'Malley, at the time admitted the intent was to create a district where the people would be more likely to elect a Democrat than a Republican. Was the reasoning the Supreme Court used in that case the same as the North Carolina
yes.
case?
Yes.
Is this a definitive decision on the topic of political gerrymandering from the court? Will the court revisit this issue sometime in the future, or is this it? We're done.
The court can always revisit it, but, you know, precedent has been set, and the court is loath to really engage in that.
Will this ruling impact lower court rulings that previously invalidated congressional maps drawn by, for instance, Republicans in Ohio and in Michigan?
This becomes the law of the land.
Future decisions or past decisions will be overturned?
Well, cases that are in the works now will have to abide by this particular decision.
So what, if anything, do these decisions yesterday, in this case, say about the makeup of this new conservative-leaning court, and what does it portend for future cases, in your view?
It is very much a conservative court. It is the Roberts conservative court. And, you know, I think the four liberals led by Justice Kagan yesterday issued a very strongly worded dissent, but they are in the minority.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, thank you for joining us this morning. A constitutional Supreme Court expert and whatnot. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about local stuff. Well, that was kind of local. We'll talk about city council. We'll talk about CMPD and many other issues as well as the roundup continues at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Let me reintroduce the panel now that Michael Bitzer has departed. Mary C. Curtis is here, columnist for RollCall.com, contributor to WCCB-TV. Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News. Jonathan Lowe, reporter, anchor from Spectrum News. And Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC-TV, Eyewitness News. Monday's city council meeting that decided the fate of the new noise ordinance was itself noisy, at least at the start, when protesters tried to take control. In the end, council decided to pass the ordinance, though they shortened noise buffers, which we'll talk about, around healthcare facilities, schools, and houses of worship from 200 to 150 feet. Mayor Pro Tem, Democratic at-large City Councilwoman Julie Eiselt said that she had received countless emails about nuisance noise from all parts of town. And that is what this ordinance was meant to address.
We're not here to regulate religion. We're not here to regulate morality. We're here to keep the peace in the city and to assure quality of life.
But protesters felt the ordinance was designed to target demonstrators in front of the A Preferred Women's Health Clinic on Latrobe Drive. Why did they believe that?
Because of the massive presence of the group called Love Life. The day of this meeting, Joe was there, and it was a sea of blue shirts, literally a sea of blue shirts that had Love Life, and they were singing in the lobby of the government center for.
But this predates that. These people have thought that this noise ordinance has always been
directly
to stop the stuff going on Latrobe
Drive. Right, because the pro-choice supporters have been complaining about some of the tactics that Love Life uses during their daily protests out there. A big issue that they have with Love Life is that they do use speakers to try to get the attention of the people seeking services.
And some of the people, pro-choice supporters were in their comments using actual examples of decibel levels, showing, you know, 5 decibels, 20, 30, and then 185, and using that to show how that impacts people coming into the clinic for services.
City Councilman Republican Ed Driggs was on this program last week and said he believed that the real reason for this noise ordinance was the Latrobe Drive disturbance, that it was a way to mask tamping down on those demonstrations. He and fellow Republican Tariq Bakari were among the three no votes. The third no vote was a Democrat, Greg right. Phipps. The other council members voted yes. Why did Greg Phipps vote no?
He basically felt like that it didn't address all of the noise ordinance issues that this city is seeing, especially in terms of entertainment districts. But Driggs has also sided with conservative causes in the past as well. For example, the anti-discrimination ordinance a couple of years ago, he voted against that.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say the council has said that this noise ordinance is content neutral, saying, you know, to Joe's point about entertainment districts, it only impacts churches, schools, and medical houses, facilities.
Yeah. So a lot of the complaints that I was privy to, because Julie Eiselt was also on this program, and she brought along a lot of emails that she's been getting from constituents all over the city because she's an at-large city council person. Many of those, if not most of the ones that I was allowed to read, were dealing with noise downtown from street musicians and the Jesus Saves guy and other people making noise downtown, sometimes throughout the business day, sometimes at night. Also trash pickup and things like that at places like Park Road Shopping Center were part of the emails that this noise ordinance was allegedly crafted to control. Will it not control that?
I think it will. It's just the focus has really been on the 150-foot buffer around schools, medical facilities, and churches.
What's wrong with that? 150 feet is less than half a football field.
Right.
So what's wrong with that?
You know, that's
and
what.
And why did they reduce it from the original?
They
200?
Did not say. They, that was a surprise to even the supporters of the clinic. Everybody thought that it would be 200 feet. It was reduced to 150 feet. I think 200 feet really is the maximum that they've seen in other cities, that what other cities have done and not been struck down in a legal challenge. So I'm not sure if they reduced it by 50 feet just to be safe here with 150.
So if you have an amplifier or a bullhorn at 150 feet or 151 feet,
right,
you can clearly be heard at the other end of that 150 feet.
Right. It makes a difference, though, because you're not right up on the clinic.
Should like you be?
The Love Life people will say you should.
Okay. Anti-abortion groups argued the buffer zone limited their right to free speech because it limited the effectiveness of amplified sound, which is to your point that you just made. And one of that's one of the tools that they use to get their message across. Daniel Parks is the executive director of Cities for Life, one of those protest groups. They're considering a lawsuit now against the city because they feel they were targeted.
We're the only people that are consistently on a regular basis using amplified sound in a context like that. So we're the only people that are going to be affected as far as that's concerned.
I don't know that, like you said, Mike, that that is completely true because I have seen in Uptown people using amplified sound.
Yes, all the
time. Yeah, and I talked to this musician. I'm sure many of you see him. He's on Tryon probably every day, or, and especially during the weekend, and that was his concern because he uses the amplifiers and said that he didn't feel like he was part of the debate and wondering if he would be able to be out there. And, of course, he has his thing where he's getting tips while he's performing.
Right. And street busking,
let's remember,
street busking is legal, right?
It is.
Okay.
And let's remember, we have a greater number of people living in Uptown. So, you know, it conceivably from all of the, and I've seen them past the 11 o'clock hour with their amplified sound because that's when you have the greatest amount of people going to, for instance, the Epicenter.
And if you're playing drums and tubas and trombones and trumpets as the group that sometimes usually sets up outside the Belk Theater as the theater lets out from shows.
Also after baseball games.
Right. You don't need amplification because those instruments are loud enough to be heard without amplification. But if you're living downtown, isn't that the trade-off? You wanted to be at the center of activity. This is the activity. You're here. Open the windows
but
and enjoy.
Not after 11:30, yeah. Mike, when I'm trying
to. This is Charlotte. People want it all.
Okay, if anyone decides to proceed with a lawsuit over this nuisance ordinance, which is, I think, scheduled to go into effect, what, in October?
October.
Will that delay that onset, or will those complaints be difficult to prove or justify going
forward? It will depend on what the judge decides, but I think the city benefits in the fact that it was content neutral and this wasn't they weren't solely targeting the protesters at the clinic. This impacts all medical facilities, all schools, all churches.
But I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that no other medical facilities have complained about noise.
Well, there's a psychologist's office, which is actually near the clinic, that has complained to Charlotte City Council about
have
this.
Have schools
as well.
Complained?
Not that I'm aware of.
Have houses of worship complained?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Actually, some of them have, according to City Council.
Okay.
They have.
I have not seen those.
All right. Charlotte's murder rate, as we all know, is right now, I believe, where it stood for all of last year, and we're only halfway through 2019. And violent crime is up as well. And this week, CMPD Chief Kerputney was critical of electronic monitoring as a way to monitor people who should not have been released, in his opinion, in the first place. Mecklenburg County's been working to keep people out of jail using electronic monitoring and reducing bail and changing the way bail is used because it hurts poorer people as opposed to rich people. And ankle bracelets are one of the ways they monitor people when they're out, and that is administered by the police department. Putney says people charged with murder and armed robbery should never be let out of jail. Are people out of jail and on electronic monitoring actually committing additional crimes?
Yes. We had the most recent shooting that we had on Bates Ford Road.
Uh-huh.
The random shooting, they said it started as a robbery. The two teens that were arrested, one of them was wearing an ankle monitor.
So how do they get out of those ankle monitors assign a perimeter in which you can operate. And if you leave that perimeter, as I understand it, it sets off an alarm. That's not working?
Well, one thing I know when I did a story about the electronic monitoring, The police said that there's a lot of kind of like people thinking that they can do things like put aluminum foil on them and they will not be able to monitor them, that there's a lot of misinformation among the people who are wearing them that they can cut them and mm-hmm. that they won't immediately
manipulate
be tracked.
Them to...
Yeah, and so they are saying that they are thinking that, so they're going ahead places they're not supposed to be, committing crimes or with other people committing crimes.
And people cut off the monitors, and then don't forget people can come visit the people on the monitors. But CMPD did release some statistics about crime committed by people on electronic monitors. They say two people were charged with murder in 2018, 25 allegedly committed robberies, and 59 people have cut off their monitors just in 2019.
So when you cut your monitor off, doesn't that send an alarm instantly to the police?
It does, and that's why CMPD sends out numerous alerts saying we're looking for this person who cut off their
anchor model. If you leave the premises because you put aluminum foil around your monitor, which is not going to block the signal.
No, it's not.
but you leave the premises or you leave the perimeter to which you have been assigned and you go off to McDonald's or wherever you go, do they come after you right away, or does it just send an alarm and they say, well, we'll get to that later on?
Now, they say that they have a person, somebody who is constantly 24/7 monitoring these people who have these electronic monitors on them. So according to what I was told, that, yes, they would go after them or, you know, send somebody, you know.
So what has been the reaction to other parts of law enforcement and the judicial process to Kerr Putney's comments about this?
There really hasn't been any reaction from the chief magistrate. They declined to comment through the spokesperson for the court system.
Mecklenburg County's chief public defender, Kevin Tully, said he was puzzled by the chief's criticism of the electronic monitoring program because the police department manages it. Mm-hmm. But Putney has seemed extremely frustrated over the last 6 or 7 months. He's expressed that frustration publicly. He's done it on this program about the rise in crime, about the rising number of murders, about the use of guns to solve petty disputes that they shouldn't be used in, about the lack of cooperation among some in the community who know who are perpetrating these crimes but will not come forward. And he says he doesn't believe all parts of the justice system are being held accountable in the same way he is. You only hear about police, which also frustrates him. And he called out, as you mentioned, the chief district judge, Regan Miller, and Caliph Rhodes, who's the chief magistrate, saying they make it too easy for dangerous criminals to get out of jail. Aren't they just doing what the law and the monitoring system and the DA tell them they can do?
Yeah, they have this authority. Yeah, they're doing what they can do. They are operating within their boundaries.
Is that criticism fair that they're doing this? They're just following the rules, right?
Yeah, and this is also taking place, the context of it, in a national movement to reduce mass incarceration and to actually, you know, help folks get out who can't afford bail. So, you know, he's running at odds with that as well because, you know, there's been criticism that people are lingering just because they can't afford bail.
But to a point that the chief made during that news conference about electronic monitoring, you know, he now asks himself, should violent criminals be allowed mm-hmm. bail? If you're in, and he's now questioning, you know, someone in jail on robbery allegations, should they get bail, even though, you know, per se, someone was not shot. So,
if the person who has to lock, who has to find and arrest these people, and who is being held accountable for the number of murders and the number of violent crimes and the number of burglaries, etc., is saying we're doing something wrong, is he likely to be listened to by people who are trying different processes to be more fair about who gets locked up and who doesn't while they're awaiting trial, because technically you're still innocent until proven guilty?
Yeah, well, you can see that you know, he's frustrated because on the one hand, yes, these forces of reform are saying we have to do this, but on the other hand, a community is saying, what are we going to do about the rising crime rates?
Right. So not only did Putney insist that some of the blame for the increase in violent crime is due to the county's new bail policy and electronic monitoring, he criticized the media for not scrutinizing the judicial branch to the same extent as they do law enforcement.
I think it's fair criticism.
Who's holding accountable every other step in the justice process? I don't have to point fingers. You should follow the facts, just like we do in any investigation. The challenge, though, that would be journalism, not simple reporting. Yeah, I took that shot, too.
Mm-hmm. Simple reporting is journalism, by the way. I just want to point that out. But you said it's a fair criticism.
I think it's fair criticism. I think we do need to take a deeper look at all aspects. I think sometimes we are just focused on what happened, what number homicide this is. But I think that we need to go that extra step and focus on whether this person is being released and if that person's committing more crime.
Well, let's parse that out. The last statement by Kerr Putney, where he said that would be journalism, not simple reporting. And reporting is journalism. Mm-hmm. But contemporary media tends to follow the horse race and the tally as opposed to getting under the skin of things. And that's partly a resource issue. If you don't have a major daily newspaper, and I would argue that we don't anymore, there's no resources in television or radio, although they're being built, they're not here yet, to do the kind of reporting that the Boston Globe does with their Spotlight series, for instance. So is he right about that? Does it fall upon us to do that, to change the way we do things?
I think it does fall upon us to make sure we're holding people accountable. And one example is these statistics that CMPD released about electronic monitors and suspects committing crime. That's something that a news organization could have found out on their own and reported. And that is a great story that I think we didn't miss.
So when he says things like that, and you work in a television newsroom, and you work in one of the top television newsrooms in the area, are these things being discussed behind the scenes by managers and news assignment editors and news directors and things like that, or did they just water off their back and they go on doing things the way they've always done?
In-depth stories are discussed every day at my station, but I will tell you that we could look at this sector a little more critically.
And my station does the exact same. We have the exact same in-depth conversations about the most responsible way to cover the rise in crime. But we do have to, I believe, keep a tally because, you know, we have more homicides, or we reached more homicides than we did last year at this time. And it was, you know, before half the year was up.
The other problem with this is, although we have the 4, the 5, the 6, the 6:30, the 7, the 10, the
right.
11.
You have to feed the beast, right.
You have to feed the beast.
Yes.
And you guys at Spectrum are 24/7
right.
all the time. That's also a resource issue. You have to feed the beast must be fed.
Right, right.
And that means something has to be on the air. And do you default to the most expedient thing, or do you have time and resources, people, to assign to these in-depth coverage stories?
I think it's a mix. I think it's a mix of trying to do things in the most thorough way, but also, you know, your own deadline every day.
Yeah.
Also, you know, you can criticize the system and try to change it, but he has to work with the system as it is right now
right.
and deal with people's frustrations.
Mary C. Curtis is with Roll Call on WCCB. Joe Bruno is WSSC-TV. Jonathan Lowe with Spectrum News and Gwendolyn Glenn with WFAE News. When we come back, County Commission, Legislature versus Sheriffs, the State Budget, and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This is the Local News Roundup. Gwendolyn Glenn is here from WFAE News. Joe Bruno from WSSE-TV. Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com and WCCB-TV. And Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News. We've talked a lot last week about the possible quarter-cent sales tax increase to support the arts. Half of the $50 million that tax would bring in would go to the Arts and Science Council, the rest to Parks and Education. This week, the commissioners really began seriously discussing this. Commission Chairman George Dunlap favors the tax, as do several others on commission, but Vice Chair Elaine Powell would rather see the bulk of the money go to parks and greenways and not the arts.
Well, I believe that the arts, science, and culture are very important. It feels like this cake was baked without authentic community input. I am troubled by the way this landed in our laps and now is being pushed with such urgency. It does not feel citizen-driven. For me, it feels like a group of people with disproportionate sway is telling us what they want and how they want us to do it.
Is she referring to the fact that the Arts and Science Council came up with this idea in the first place?
Yes.
Yes, she is.
Okay. Something new emerged from these discussions. County Manager Dina DiOrio suggested changing the governance of the Arts and Science Council to ensure commissioners and the public know exactly how this newly raised money would be spent. Others suggested a new arts group attached to the Foundation for the Carolinas or the creation of an entirely new nonprofit organization to dole out the money. How much traction did those ideas receive?
It seems like there's a lot of discussion over those topics. They haven't really set on one particular one, and they really just punted that discussion. And it sounds like they're not even going to take it up next week either. They're really just going to push this off to August. I know Pat Cotham texted me, and she says she has concerns about this being voted on or decided on before that governance is set. But it does not look like commissioners have any desire to tackle this issue.
Hmm. Former County Commissioner Republican Matthew Ridenour has started a petition against this new sales tax. One of the things he points out, in addition to letting people know that this is a regressive tax and that it affects poorer people more heavily than rich people, is that all county taxes, I didn't know this until he pointed this out, all county taxes go into the general revenue fund. And although this board of county commissioners may promise the money will go to the arts, a future board may decide to use it differently, and there would be nothing anyone could do about it. Is he right?
He's right.
Yes, he is.
What's interesting is, is that he's starting this petition. He's trying to build some momentum against this tax because we have not seen that during any of the meetings. The only person who actually spoke against it that's a constituent is Sam Spencer, who's kind of plugged in as it is. Pat Cotham has come out against it. Elaine Powell is against the revenue for it, but she hasn't really spoken out against the tax itself.
Well, Matthew Ridenour is a Republican who lost his seat
when
all Republicans were swept off the county commission. So it's an all-Democratic county commission. Does it even surprise you that there are people who are hesitating on this on county commission, given the makeup of it?
No, not really, because Commissioner Cotham has been, since this board became all-Democrat, I will say that she, from the very beginning, said that she was going to scrutinize, just because she was a Democrat didn't mean that she wasn't going to scrutinize everything that has come through. And she has been on several measures that they have voted on, the one no vote. So I think I wouldn't assume that this board, just because they're Democrat, is going to pass something like this. And we saw that this week with, you know, Elaine Powell raised question, you know, with how this has come about. So it's not like everybody is saying yes right now.
So let's shift focus to Raleigh here for a second. Governor Roy Cooper has called the effort by state lawmakers to require sheriffs to cooperate with immigration authorities unconstitutional. Yet this week, the state Senate voted yes on a House bill, House Bill 370. What happens to that bill? And that bill would force sheriffs to cooperate with ICE. What happens to that bill now?
It is up to the governor. We're waiting to see. He has indicated, he said, he put out a statement that he doesn't like it, calls it unconstitutional.
Is he unlikely to sign it?
It's unlikely. This happened several days ago, and we haven't heard. You know,
the Republicans lost their supermajority in November of last year. Do they have the votes to override a gubernatorial veto on this bill?
I don't think they have the votes at this time.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, and this has so many levels and layers on it.
Yep.
Some of these sheriffs, many of them campaigned on stopping this cooperation.
Right.
Many of them African-American. They say that there's racial overtones to the criticism. And they say basically that they don't want the communities to lose trust and not, you know, lose trust in law enforcement because of this.
Sheriff McFadden had a news conference out in front of the jail, I believe it was Tuesday or Wednesday, basically the same day that the Senate was voting. And the news conference was with various faith leaders from the community. It was interfaith, so, you know, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, all supporting the sheriff, basically calling this HB 370 racially motivated. The sheriff then said, and according to Comunidad Colectiva, there were only three counties that were participating out of 100. There were only three that were participating. It's a voluntary program. And so now that we have HB 370 and the Sheriff's Association initially saying that they were not going to support it, then they came on board. The sheriff says, you know, this is all the result of six African American sheriffs across the state who have said they will not work with ICE.
So the legislature is also dealing with the budget. The House and Senate have reached an agreement on a $24 billion budget, but there are some friction there, too, between lawmakers and the governor over Medicaid expansion. The governor has called the budget bad and with the wrong priorities. So aside from friction over Medicaid, what are the governor's objections?
Medicaid is the big one. I'm not sure if he's too pleased with the teacher pay aspect of it. I know he was seeking more education promises than he was given in that budget.
And he has said that, well, he has hinted that he might veto any budget that doesn't include Medicaid expansion. If he were to do that once again, could the legislature override that veto?
That one, I think that the legislature, I know that there have been some, not every Democrat is wanting Medicare or Medicaid. So
there are teacher and state employee pay raises in both the House and the Senate versions of this budget bill. What did they agree on? Do we know that?
The average teacher pay raise, according to the Senate, would be about 3.5% over 2 years. House teachers were in the House, the teachers would have gotten a raise of about 4.6%.
You also, Joe, reported this week that the budget contains an odd proposal.
Yes.
Talk about that. It's $85,000 to Stanley County for what?
The Republican National Convention.
Okay. Are they hosting?
It just caught my eye because, you know, Stanley County, it's not Cabarrus, it's not Union, it's not Gaston even, it's Stanley County. That's about an hour northeast of Charlotte. So I'm like, why does Stanley County need funding for the Republican National Convention? Is the delegation going to be staying in a motel in Albemarle? What's going on there?
Tourism.
Exactly. But I asked the Stanley County manager, and he clarified this a little bit. He said that money would be used for potentially emergency management staging if it needs to be.
Okay.
Stanley's got a lot.
Wait a minute. They stole that from us. All right. The compromise budget also includes a mandate for schools statewide to teach about the Holocaust and financial literacy. Arts classes are required between the 6th and the 12th grade. Where did those proposals come from, Gwen?
Well, CMS put out a list of things, and some of those were not on their list. Their top priority was the K through 3 funding. They needed funding
for
reducing the size of classrooms, and that was their number one priority on that list. And the General Assembly gave them money for the extra teachers that they will need when these class sizes are reduced in 2 years. But they didn't give them any money for buildings, for the 200 classrooms that CMS say they will need in order to accommodate those reduced class sizes.
Are they likely to get that money between now and the time the budget has to be passed and signed?
They're still pushing for it because they're like, our choice is to increase the class size of the upper classes, and they could go up to 45 students. They say that it's $200 million for if they just do trailers. But some schools don't have space for trailers.
Right.
So they're saying that they're kind of in a hard place of the only thing we're seeing that to comply with this is to increase the size of the upper grades, which they do not want to do.
Right.
So they're still pushing for that. That was their number one priority. They also, one thing they did get, which was their number two priority, they said, was funding for the early college schools. And they have about 800 students who are in the early college school programs. And this helps students in that you get college credit. So some have enough credits for an associate degree once they graduate from high school. So when you go to a four-year college, you could finish earlier. So, again, that's saving them a lot of money. So they did get that.
We talked a little bit about this, I think, when it happened. Bennett College announced the abrupt departure of their president. Was it last week or the week before?
Yes, it was a week ago.
Okay,
yes.
Phyllis Wirt Dawkins, she resigned. No one has given any reason to this day as to why she resigned. They said it was a personnel issue they couldn't talk about. But this morning, we know that there's a new head of the college.
They did, and they did it very quickly. And we don't know if she resigned, was fired, or what. We don't know why she. The day they made the announcement that she would be departing, it was effective immediately. So we have no idea. I've asked, I've called, and they said they wanted to have someone in place by the beginning of the fall season. Well, within a week, Suzanne Walsh, she is going to be the next president.
Where does she come from?
She has a background. She's an attorney. Excuse me. She has worked with the various foundations in education, and she will be taking over August 1st.
Phyllis Dawkins, who was the previous president, had just run this successful fundraising campaign for Bennett College, which is an all-girls, historically black school in Greensboro. Their goal was $5 million. They raised $9.5 million.
Almost doubled it, yes.
This is a puzzle.
People are asking those questions, and I've been asking those questions, too. And I talked to the president of the National Alumni Association for Bennett, and I asked that exact question. You know, a lot of people from around the country gave money. Some gave large amounts. $1 million came from someone whose two aunts graduated from there. So you have a lot of people who were behind the Stand With Bennett campaign, and she was the face of it. She was on 1A, NPR's 1A. She was on the Today Show. She was on national news program. So she was the face of that campaign. And as she said, she was even on the street, she said, with at times buckets asking people support us with her Stand With Bennett. So, yeah, she was the face, and it was successful. And now she's gone, and nobody is saying why.
So that's a puzzle that has yet to be solved. Here's another puzzle that some light was shed on this week. Axios obtained records from the Trump administration that highlighted what they called red flags surrounding any potential appointment of former North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory to a position within the administration. Given the track record of some of the people that made it into that administration, what problems did they find with Pat McCrory that were so egregious that he couldn't get a job at the White House?
Some of the things that they highlighted were, I guess, former Governor McCrory said, like, Trump's mouth needs to be washed out with soap. He said that once. They highlighted how he spins.
Well, Mick Mulvaney, who was the former budget director and who is now the acting, because everybody's acting, the acting chief of staff, called Trump a terrible human being. He's there.
Maybe not for long.
They also said that McCrory is thin-skinned, and they also highlighted some of his ties to Duke Energy as well as HB2.
You know, I know Pat McCrory, and I don't think he's thin-skinned. I mean, things do affect you as a person.
Right.
But I think he lets it roll off. I really do. I mean, if you listen to his radio show, which is on right now, he sometimes appears to be, but he's driving a radio show. That's different. He talks about when I was governor. That's what he does. But just talking to him personally behind the scenes, I don't think that's true.
As you pointed out, though, you know, it seems like with all the other people who had incredibly ethical problems and personal problems, he might be feeling a little bit thin-skinned now about how come I didn't make the cut.
One thing that was a red flag that's interesting is that they saw that it was a red flag that he signed
HB2,
which when you look at what the Trump administration has done with the military and transgender service members, it is very confusing.
They were concerned about his alleged favoritism to Duke Energy. He was suspected of protecting Duke Energy following the coal ash spill on the Dan River. They referred to his refusal to concede the 2016 election, really? And he signed legislation mandating a 72-hour waiting period before an abortion. Those were red flags. This seems
oddly similar to what we're seeing from the administration.
Weird. Well, he's not Trump's son-in-law, so.
Okay, so very quickly, Panther owner David Tepper has made no secret of ambitions to bring Major League Soccer to town. It appears the organization may be meeting with the MLS Expansion Committee as soon as next month. SportsIllustratedSI.com reports the MLS likes billionaires, and Tepper is one 12 times over. He's estimated to be the 118th richest person in the world. So he has a desire to bring an MLS team here. He's rich, and He just happens to have a stadium. Is this a done deal? Are they coming?
This is the most momentum it's ever had. It's MLS, I would say, is looking very favorably on Charlotte right now.
Okay. And even if that doesn't, there is a new soccer league that's coming, and I think they have a big announcement today where they're saying, you know, it's growing. You have a large audience for soccer, so it's a new league. It's going to be not connected to that, but it's coming.
Wendell and Glenn gets the last word from WFAE News. Joe Bruno, reporter for WSFC TV News. Mary C. Curtis, columnist, contributor to RollCall.com at WCCB TV, and then a newly minted award winner.
Thank you.
Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for our Spectrum News. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.